Good afternoon. Welcome back to America's Workforce, broadcast from Ohio for workers around the entire world and archived on awfradio.com. Let's go to line number two. I always enjoy talking to this guy. He is Ed Witkin, president of the Transportation Trades Department of the AFL-CIO. TTD.org is their website. Hey, Ed, welcome back to the show.
How you doing, Flash?
I'm doing well. In fact, I saw some video the other day about the wildfires in California, and then I got their story. And I was reading about these drones. I'm saying, wait a minute. And we hear so much about the drones over in the Middle East. I mean, they're really, really popular. They're well used. But apparently, a lot of people are using them here. And there's all kind of stories. And there's problems connected with them because it doesn't seem like there's much of a policy when it comes to our federal government. So talk to me. Apparently... This fire out in San Bernardino County, there it's a brush fire, which is real common. Every year these pop up, and then all of a sudden a drone comes by?
Yeah, you know, we've been at this drone issue for a while. The Amazon CEO tried to make them really hip as an important commercial development, and while we understand the commercial use of drones, they have to be done safely. So, yeah, you got this fire in San Bernardino, and there were five drones hovering over the fire. Because, you know, what happens is these drone operators, they want to be, you know, in the middle of all the action, no matter what the action might be. And the firefighters had to wait a little less than a half hour to be able to do another Passover with water. And it cost them an entire Passover with water, which, you know, fortunately, from what I can tell, didn't kill anybody. But in the end, yeah, it got in the way of firefighting. So this is just exhibit A of a problem we've been talking about now for a while, which is, until the FAA figures out a way to safely integrate drones into our airspace, we should not allow their widespread use. It's dangerous, puts pilots and passengers at risk, and in this case, puts innocent victims at risk, right? People who are victims of fires who can't even have their fire fought by firefighters in time. So, pretty serious issue.
So, does the FAA realize the severity of this? I mean, we know they're flying all over the place, and it's just like... causing a mishmash of issues. Is there any kind of a policy that they may be thinking about at this stage?
Yeah, actually, the FAA has been tough job that place to run it. Michael Huerta is the head of the FAA, and he's been under incredible pressure from the corporate lobby, folks like Amazon, who are trying to get the FAA to clear these things. And, yeah, they actually have a pretty rigorous rulemaking process going on right now. And it's designed to be able to prove that you can integrate these things safely. And, you know, you got to understand, it's not just about integrating them in the airspace safely. It's also making sure that the operators know what they're doing. So what we're arguing is that if they're going to share the airspace with commercial pilots, then they should be trained and certified like pilots are. You can't just dot the sky, you know, with these things and expect the operator to know what they're doing, especially these hobbyists who are likely, that's who likely was involved in this firefighter situation were hobbyists who thought it was really hip to put drones up above a fire.
And then you got that teen in Connecticut who added a semi-automatic handgun to a drone?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot. I have to tell you, you know, what's funny, this is one of those classic examples where we sort of rain on someone else's parade.
Uh-huh.
Because there's this drumbeat of corporate lobbying and all this great fanfare around drones. And we completely understand why there's a lot of excitement about their application. But TTD and the Airline Pilot Association and some of our other airline unions, among others, have really been trying to throw caution into the wind here, so to speak, because what's happening is the momentum's been building to do this. And, you know, they want to do all sorts of things with drones, including infrastructure inspections. They want to do oil exploration. I mean, there's all these things that they think they can use drones for. And we're saying, go slow, take your time, and don't crowd up our airspace with these things so quickly. And by the way, air traffic controllers are ultimately responsible, if you know, for the movement of everything in our sky. So you introduce a bunch of drones, potentially thousands and thousands of them, it becomes an even more complicated airspace.
Oh, yeah. What a mess. And this kid in Connecticut, I was reading about this at the top of the show, apparently somebody found out what he was doing, and then the police investigated, and they realized that he wasn't doing anything wrong. with the adding a semi-automatic handgun to the drone. It's like, whoa. Well,
yeah,
obviously, if you hurt somebody, yeah.
Well, what's interesting about that is even if you don't want to inject your own value judgment about, you know, firearms and gun safety and gun control, just the notion that some person can put a semi-automatic weapon on a drone and put it up in the sky, who knows what their intention is with that, right? So it's probably not very good most of the time.
This is an issue that's going to get a whole lot of play. I just got an email the other day from Radio Shack, and they're saying they have a drone now that they want to sell you. So, my gosh.
Well, you know, Andy, we took a little bit of grief because people are so defensive about it, but we said in our policy statement, and this was, you know, over a year ago, actually about a year ago, we said simply because Amazon's CEO is in a hurry to fill our skies with the company's prime air vehicles isn't a good reason to open the floodgates to commercial drone use in our national airspace system. And that's the problem here, is you got one of the most powerful companies in the world that wants to introduce vehicles for delivery.
Right.
And while that may seem like a neat commercial idea, take a pause and make sure you do it safely.
Exactly. And you notice this is just another example of taking the worker out of the equation. You know that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Pretty soon there'll be nobody left carrying credit cards buying anything in our economy.
I know.
The rate we're going.
Yeah. Let's just eliminate work altogether in America.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Let's talk about the Highway Trust Fund. We had a local commissioner talking about it and how it affects his community. And it's a good example. And you hear so many crazy arguments. Oh, let the states do that kind of thing. And there's one stretch over here of I-90 that goes into Lake County, which was a $200 million price tag for the federal government. I don't know of any state in this country that could pick up a tab like that, do you?
No, I don't. And, you know, there's been this this steady creeping effect of these ideas, because that's what happens when you abdicate your responsibility in Washington and you don't pass a long-term bill and you don't put a real funding mechanism in there, like, for example, a gas tax increase. Then you have all these sort of kooky ideas out there that says, oh, yeah, we'll just let the states do it. This thing's still stuck. It's not a particularly strong bill in the Senate. It's okay. It raises money beyond baseline levels. But we're still not where we need to be. We're nowhere near the end zone. We're barely at the 50-yard line because this bill isn't even fully funded, the one that's pending in the Senate. And there's some policy issues in this bill that we're not particularly thrilled with. But I think this bill's in trouble. And meanwhile, yeah, you've got these big stretches of roads across America that aren't getting repaired or modernized. And it's a stain on our economy.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is creating huge problems.
Do they still want to take the money out of Medicare to fund this?
There's been a bunch of pay-fors that have fortunately been sort of scrapped. There was actually a Social Security provision at one point, which is no longer in play. For a while, and we've talked about this on the air over the last several years, there was someone who, again, tried to take it out of the hides of federal workers,
right,
by taking some of their pension benefits away. So that's a continuing effort. The bill itself now, its funding streams, nothing terribly controversial, but there's some provisions in there that both Democrats and Republicans don't like, both on policy and funding. And then if they pass it, they still have a big funding responsibility to get done, because this bill basically funds about 3 of the 6 years.
That's
right?
It.
Only in Washington do you pass a bill that with great fanfare declares 6 years of new investment, but only provides funding for 3. So I wish I could. Can I run my household like that? I'll just pay like 3 every 6 years. I'll pay 3 years worth of my mortgage.
Right. Yeah. Well, the banks will love you for that.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh. And then there's Chris Christie. Now, all of a sudden, you got to explain this story to our listeners, because now he had an opportunity to build new tunnels under the Hudson River, and he killed the plan. But again, if he's elected president, that could change. Am I reading this correctly?
You are, yeah. I mean, he's taken hypocrisy to an absolute new level. I didn't think that was possible, by the way, with what I listened to around here. But Chris Christie, as governor, killed the largest public works project in the country, which was to build a new Hudson River tunnel. And for those that don't pay attention to the Northeast Corridor, who might live in Cleveland or somewhere else, that is the busiest transportation corridor in the country. Those tunnels are well over 100 years old. I believe one of them is 140 years old. And it would have put about 50,000 people to work building this thing. And Chris Christie canceled it. And then, in the middle of a proclamation running for president in Iowa, he said, as president, and this is the funny part, I will bring the Secretary of Transportation, my secretary, into a meeting with the New Jersey governor, Perrin, that would be you, sir, right now, close Perrin, and the governor of New York, and we'll figure this out. So my question to him is, why don't you figure it out right now?
Right.
Because you're the governor of New Jersey. You don't need to wait till you're president. By the way, you're polling at about 10th or 11th place right now. So
yeah.
I'm not really sure you're ever going to have that chance. But, yeah, the hypocrisy is incredible, Flash. And the worst part is they blamed Amtrak for it, too. There was a shutdown of one of the tunnels because of electrical issues. That's what happens when you have over 100-year-old tunnels. You have issues like electrical problems. And it shut down service for about an hour. And then it caused, of course, a lot of commuter chaos. And then Christie blamed Amtrak for it.
Unbelievable.
So, a lot of finger-pointing going on.
I guess. What about the United Flight Attendants? I saw the story about a week and a half, maybe 2 weeks ago. They did a day of action to call attention to their work conditions. And I see you picked up on that. What do we know about that?
Yeah,
right,
I showed up at an event with my flight attendant friends at Dulles Airport in Virginia. And essentially, it was a day of action to basically put a spotlight on the fact that, you know, United is one of the big surviving airlines now, right? We've had a massive consolidation, both through bankruptcy and mergers. And United is now poised to be the largest airline in the world and will be for a while. And the employees have stuck through a lot of difficult times, 9/11, bankruptcies. There's been a pension dump at United where workers lost their pension. And the surviving workforce has helped rebuild the brand into the largest airline in the world. And now they're saying it's time for you to reward your employees. And United is nickel and diming them to death at the bargaining table. So that's what this fight's about, is giving these workers the rights, the benefits and the wages that they deserve for rebuilding this company from bankruptcy.
You know, it just kills me, too, because you got, you know, when times are bad, the CEO will say, you know, I don't know if we're going to make it here. This company could go bankrupt.
Yeah.
You got a union contract that means your wages and everything will go out the window if you don't take a pay cut. So the workers often take the pay cut. They pay more for their benefits. But when the times get better, oddly enough, the CEO just doesn't want to share in that. And this is a perfect example about this guy, Jeff, what is it, Smysek?
Yeah. No, it's right. And they've got it backwards, right? If you want to build a company for the long term, you have to build these partnerships, not just when the company is about to go over the cliff and faces possible bankruptcy or actual bankruptcy. You should be building these partnerships when the company's doing well, and that's how you create the morale you need. It's how you create the productivity you need, and it's how you create the kind of workforce you need, especially in a service-oriented business like airlines. But, yeah, they always have it backwards, and now they're going to fight them for every nickel and dime. And Sarah Nelson, the president of the union, who's a member of my executive committee, I joined her at this event. She's got this union really, really focused on getting the right kind of contract. And the amount of excitement around the country was off the charts. And I have a lot of confidence they're going to get to the table and get a good deal from this company, because this company has no choice but to partner with the workforce that makes this company go.
Yeah.
And that's my hope. And we're going to do everything we can to support them.
Yeah, the CEO got a 32% pay increase. Jet, when's the last time workers got a 32% pay increase?
Got me, man. I don't remember. If it happened, I must have been sleeping. I missed it. Yeah.
You were dreaming on that one,
I was
right?
Dreaming. There you go.
Oh, my gosh. Well, Ed, we're almost out of time. I saw the story, too. Let's save this for next month about Uber.
Yeah, we should talk about that.
Yeah, everybody is using Uber. And and there's another side of that story.
Yeah, there is. If you have a few seconds, you know, it's a $40 billion company. It pays its employees about $15,000 annually, and they're not even employees. They abuse independent contractor rules. They have these obscene commissions they collect from each one of their trips. And, of course, they're not paying taxes on these employees, right? So the
right.
employees are responsible for Social Security and Medicare. And, yeah, they're getting clobbered all over the world now with governments and citizens that are sick and tired of it. And we're hopeful that there's, you know, momentum building to force Uber to act like a real employer that treats employees the right way. That's basically what's at the center of this.
Yeah, let's save this for another broadcast because there's a lot more details I want to share with our listeners, but we'll do that next time, okay?
Look forward to it.
Very good. Ed Witkin on our live line. He's head of the Transportation Trades Department of the AFL-CIO. That's it for another edition of America's Workforce. Tomorrow, the Ohio Labor Roundup featuring the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers. Until then, all of you have a wonderful day.
This has been America's Workforce, heard right here on WERE-AM 1490, courtesy of the American Workers Radio Network. Tune in every Monday through Friday for another hour of Worker Power with Ed Flash Ferris. America's Workforce is produced by Labor Tools, powered by BMA Media Group.